You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 18th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow, the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, as he is apparently wrapping up his blogging career, David Dayen, Fire Dog Lake News, in his final week of blogging, final two or three days of blogging, here to talk to us about his time blogging, why he's taken off the liberal media echo chamber, and yes, I've got to ask him about this raw deal that has been floated by the White House on the fiscal cliff negotiations. We will get to that briefly and where it stands. I remind you, Joe Biden flatly guaranteed no changes to Social Security. Apparently, President Obama wasn't reading the papers that day during the campaign. Also on the program today, the Daily News comes out for an all-assault weapon ban. That's big news. There are going to be protests this week at the home of the Cerebus. Am I saying that right? Cerebus? The big hedge fund, which I think owns Chrysler, or they did. Also owns the Freedom Group, which in turn owns or invests heavily in gun manufacturers. Daniel Inouye, the longest-serving senator in the Senate, passes away. Chuck Hagel being attacked for being anti-Jewish. His stock rises with me every day, not because I think he's anti-Jewish, but because I appreciate the enemies that he seems to have assembled in terms of his foreign policy. We will talk more about that later. Todd Akin, his final FU as he exits the House. We will talk all more about that. Richard Engel also apparently was kidnapped and now escaped, essentially, from his captors in Syria. But first, quickly, well, we're going to go to We're going to go to I got a story about the Rolling Jubilee sending out its first debt forgiveness letters. We're going to go to David Dayan in a second. I just want to say on the blog, we have a link to Credo's action to pressure your senators and your House members not to sign on to any deal that involves the cutting of Social Security or Medicare. It's a good time for me to remind you, A, to go and do that. That's crucial. Less crucial, but still helpful, but certainly less crucial. If there's one thing that you do today, contact your congresspeople, your senators, tell them that you will hold them accountable if they cut Social Security. If you live in a district where you have a Republican congressman, then contact that Republican congressman or woman and tell them if you allow taxes to be raised on anybody in this country, you will consider them a traitor to freedom. And you will hold them accountable. They'll be freedom destroyers. This deal's got to sink, ladies and gentlemen. So, secondly, let me remind you about Credo. You'll hear an ad coming up in just a minute. But you have until December 31st to go to Credo. We've got credomobile.com/majority report. December 31st, they've got a great deal for you. They're a big supporter of this program. They are experimenting to see how many of you are going to be interested in their actions and in their phone service. I've told you all this stuff before. You'll hear it in the ad, but you've got to December 31st. It is time to make your move, ladies and gentlemen. Make that move. We'll talk about it later in the program, but we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll be talking to David Dayan. But go to that Credo Action link at the very least and contact your peeps. All right, we'll be back in a sec. Hey guys, listeners of the Majority Report know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to our sponsors. And I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. They're the only progressive cell company out there. This is really the best of both worlds for me. I'm so excited, I can barely even say the words. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, one that holds Democrats accountable, one that funds the progressive movement, and finally helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy for you to sign up now. Go to credomobile.com/majority. That's credomobile.com/majority. You'll get 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year. You'll get true unlimited data. No hinky-dinky, you went over with your megabytes. And they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers that you're stuck with now, so that when you show them your bill, essentially, you won't pay a Credo bill until you go over $350. It's a great deal. Go to credomobile.com/majority right now.
Oh!
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome this guest back to the program. But also with a certain amount of sadness. This is not goodbye. It's just see you later, maybe. But David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake News. David, about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, you announced that you were done blogging on December 21st.
Yes, I did not recognize at the time how closely that aligned with the end of the Mayan calendar. But it was not done in the expectation that there would be no news after the apocalypse.
Right. There you go. Well, all right. I want to talk about those reasons why, but let me preface the other question I have by first saying that, you know, I've been a huge fan of yours for at least just off the top of my head, maybe 6 or 7 years when you were writing. I think I first came across your writing at Digby's blog, maybe before then. I think when you had dday.blogspot.com up, I was pulling your feed for the Air America website. You've always been one of the guys that I've really had just been incredibly impressed with in terms of your writing, the clarity, the work that you did, your intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to get that out of the way before I ask you a question that's completely unrelated to your decision to stop.
Well, I do appreciate that, and I appreciate the outpouring of support that I've gotten from people, not just in my comments and on Twitter, but email and virtually all over the place. People have expressed their gratitude and always adding, you know, tell me where to find you next, so it's really nice to see. And you know, sometimes when you live in the blogging bubble, you don't even have a sense that anyone's paying attention to this stuff. So it was nice to get that recognition from the people who read you every day.
Well, it can feel like a thankless job, and I know that, but I got to tell you that. I am going to feel your absence in a way that I don't even want to contemplate, frankly.
Very nice of you. Thanks.
So, all right. With that said, I want to get to the reasons and just some of your thoughts on having done this for so long and being such a big part of the Netroots and the reporting that you have been doing. But, you know, to have you here and not discuss this latest proposal would be like having a famous chef in your kitchen who's got the hat on and sitting there with a spatula and saying, sorry, I don't have any ingredients for you. Well, that's a bad analogy, but whatever. The point being, we have seen the first offer or the latest offer coming from the White House. Just break it down for us briefly and give me a sense of what your feelings about this offer are and what we know about whether or not Boehner is going to accept it.
Yeah, I guess this is the third offer, right, from the White House responding to some counteroffers. And the ostensible goal here is to avert the fiscal cliff, what is commonly called the fiscal cliff. Now, in the event that we did not avert that Congress just took no action, between $500 and $600 billion of austerity would hit this year. Under this deal...
Now, wait a second. Well, will you just break down the austerity that you're talking about, that $500 or $600 billion?
Right.
Just give me a slight break.
It comes from a variety of sources, yes. It comes from a variety of sources. One is the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts, which is probably about half of that.
Okay.
You also have the sequester on both discretionary and defense spending. That's about $100 billion for the next fiscal year. I'm always, when I'm talking about these numbers, I'm just talking about for 2013.
Okay.
You have the expiration of the payroll tax cut, which was a stimulus program that would cost, be $125 billion in austerity over 2013. And then you have a variety of other measures, whether it's unemployment benefits expiring, the doc fix, which prevents a cut to the reimbursement rates in Medicare for doctors, and several other things, that if everything went over the cliff, it would be something around $600 billion.
Now, we should say also the implications of those different figures are different. In other words,
exactly.
the multiplier exactly. for the $300 billion worth of tax cut austerity is not equivalent to the austerity impact of $300 billion, if there was such a thing, of, let's say, unemployment insurance ending or payroll taxes ending, because that money is spent more readily by the people who are the beneficiaries of those stimulative programs, let's say.
Right, and by and large, spending, federal spending goes to vulnerable populations and people who need it and will spend the money. And so spending usually has a higher multiplier than taxes. The payroll tax cut, which is fairly well targeted to middle-class families, it's really a wage subsidy, has more of a stimulus impact than tax cuts for the rich. So this latest offer, if you look at it relative to that, my back-of-the-envelope calculation is that it would have about $300 billion in austerity in 2013. And what gets cut out is mostly those tax cuts, Bush-era tax cuts, up to the first $400,000, because the president changed his target. Now the dividing line is not $250,000, but in this latest offer, $400,000 a year. Only the top marginal tax rate, rather than the top two marginal tax rates, would go up under this plan. If you look over the course of the whole plan, in the sequester, there was about $984 billion in spending cuts, and those were targeted to discretionary defense spending and holding social insurance spending harmless. In this latest offer, there's $922 billion in spending cuts, and it does not hold social insurance cuts harmless. In fact, there are $400 billion in unidentified Medicare or health program cuts. That could be Medicare, Medicaid, or various other things, I assume. And there is this change CPI, this change to the calculation of the cost of living adjustment, change to the inflation index, that would impact Social Security benefits and make them grow more slowly over time. It's really a benefit cut.
Slowly over time relative to inflation. So the reality is, yes,
yeah.
it's a cut in practice.
Absolutely. In terms of the purchasing power, it's cut. So there's almost no difference between going over the cliff, as it were, and taking the Obama deal in terms of spending. In terms of spending cuts, they are almost equal. And you can argue that since they hit social insurance programs, which are targeted at the poor and the elderly, that they would have a more disparate impact than just doing nothing and going over the cliff. So that's the context for when you're looking at this deal. There's basically no change on the spending side. It's arguably worse because of the cuts to social insurance. The tax issue is somewhat the same as if as I said, the $250,000 dividing line has changed. It's only the top marginal tax rate that would go up under the Obama plan. At $400,000 above. Then there was all this unidentified other tax revenue increases that would get you to $1.2 trillion in revenue increases under this deal relative to just letting the top two tax rates expire, which would get you about $800 billion. So there's about a 50% increase in revenue from that, But the spending cuts are the same. Presumably, you take in more taxes so that you can finance spending by government. But what we're saying here is we're going to take in more taxes, and we're going to apply that to deficit reduction, and we're going to do the same amount of spending cuts that were envisioned previously under the fiscal slope. Yeah.
Very bad recipe in terms of if your one goal is to in some way prevent a deepening or a continuing stagnation of the recession or the anemic recovery, let's say.
Right. Oh, wait, there's more. But not only would this be about $300 billion, there are some stimulus ideas here. You would extend unemployment insurance, and there's some vague notion of increased infrastructure spending under this deal. But it's about one-tenth of the overall spending cuts that are envisioned in the deal, if that. I mean, the numbers are kind of indeterminate here. But the biggest thing, one of the biggest things, in addition to that, is that we get to rerun this in 2 years because the debt limit under this proposed plan would only be increased for the next 2 years under the deal, which means that come 2014, the Boehner rule, which is that you don't increase the debt limit without one subsequent decrease in spending or in, entitlement reforms or social insurance reform, that would still be in place. And in 2014, you would have to raise the debt limit again. And if John Boehner has anything to say about it, and if Mitch McConnell has anything to say about it, and by the way, in 2014, I don't think that the theory is that Democrats will suddenly get 60 votes in the Senate, or that they will, and even taking back the House, getting the 17 seats necessary, is a bit of a long shot, although a lot of things can happen in 2 years. If Republicans are still in a position to take the debt limit hostage, they will, and they have the ability to, under this deal in 2 years.
And I would argue that not only even if all things are equal as of today, will Democrats not be in a better position, but the moment that that deal is sealed, you've got a lot of Republican operatives going around saying, Democrats, the guys who cut your Social Security, which
exactly.
I think is going to cost anywhere from 10 to 20 seats in the House, I think, at a minimum, because they were so effective doing this last time in 2010 in terms of Medicare. So,
I mean, the whole time in this debate, Republicans have been daring Democrats to put the cuts, particularly the social insurance programs, on the table themselves. They said, you come up with the tax increases and you come up with the benefit cuts. Democrats essentially were in the position of negotiating with themselves.
Right.
And here the president did it. And now, as they ran the same game in 2010, when they said, look what Democrats did to cut your Medicare, they can run around and say, look what Democrats did, even if they voted for it, too.
Of course.
They can say, look what Democrats did to cut your Social Security.
Of course, because this was put on the table by the president first. I mean, that's the thing, you know, that's the and even look, the Republicans have shown that they have no compunction about making that argument. They've done it before. So
absolutely.
There's no reason to think it would be irrational to think that they won't do it again. It would be highly irrational to believe that. So, okay, with that said, now we have Dick Durbin apparently came out today, said no cut in Social Security benefits. That's just been reported by Greg Sargent over at the Plumb Line. We have Boehner saying, we're going to go to our plan B, I guess, which is plan Boehner, where I don't know if he named it after himself, where we've heard now Pelosi saying plan B won't fly. Do you think there is going to actually be a deal here? Because I was just shocked last night at about whatever time it was that all this sort of was, it was around, I don't know, 7 p.m. Ezra Klein comes out with his story, or 6 p.m. or 5 p.m. And then everybody seems to have had it. And by 11 p.m., people are reporting on this as if it's already been signed. You know, I mean, it was just stunning the way this was.
That's usually the case in our 24-hour media cycle, that everyone immediately jumps in to assess the deal. But, you know, I mean, we saw this with the Medicare eligibility age. These things are floated for a reason. They need to gauge the public response of their respective bases. And so it's important to participate in that discussion.
Definitely.
As I think you've alluded to on a number of occasions. So maybe this is getting a worse response than we think if people are edging away with it from it within the first 24 hours. Its report.
And this is when it's so key, too, because you want to stop its momentum. This trial balloon gets up there. It's always, you know, look, you want to knock down a trial balloon. It's much easier to do it when it's at 5 feet than when it's at 50 feet.
Right. I also should say that, you know, you had people like Paul Krugman coming out and saying they were marginally positive on this idea, that it was better than raising the eligibility age for Medicare. You have the center.
But now he said that last night at 11. This morning he started moving the other direction.
But it was out there.
Yep.
You have the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which has long argued in favor of a chain CPI for Social Security, changing the inflation index, as long as it did something to protect the poor somehow in that. Poor seniors within that. I don't know how you would do that and still save money, since the latest poverty statistics show that 15.1% of seniors live in poverty. This is an argument for raising Social Security benefits, not for cutting them.
Yeah, and when we're talking about these cuts to Social Security benefits, we also got to tell people we're talking about what is like $100 billion over the course of 10 years. This is piddling stuff.
There are two things. There are two things to say here. One, it would not close the long-term funding gap.
Not even close.
Barely close. Barely a third of it. And in other words, you would be saying, let's do this cut, and then we're still going to have that conversation around Social Security sometime in the future, when everyone will argue for a balanced solution. But it won't be a balanced solution because we'll all have already done this cut.
Right, definitely.
So that's number one. Number two is the more obvious thing, that Social Security does not contribute to the deficit whatsoever and never has in 75 years. Why is it part of a deficit discussion if it is not something that is something that's funded out of dedicated revenue that has nothing to do with the budget? The chain CPI also would be used on other things that involve the cost of living adjustment, apparently. That includes food stamps, that includes veterans benefits, that includes pensions and even salaries, perhaps, for some government workers who get their annual raise based on cost of living adjustment. So this could have factors. It also could affect tax brackets. If those go up based on a chain CPI, so those would go up more slowly, and if wages rose faster than that measure of inflation, what you end up having is a regressive tax increase as a result.
It would actually add, on average, about $100 to people's tax to people's taxes, but it will particularly hit. That's on average now, but it will particularly hit those people who I think make between $30,000 and $50,000 a year.
Exactly.
Which
it's
is
a regressive tax increase. So, and Republicans, by the way, are resisting that part of it. They don't mind the benefit cuts, but they're trying to hold off the regressive tax increase. So we don't know exactly everything that chain CPI would apply to, but we know that applying it to Social Security as a budget answer is ridiculous, because Social Security doesn't affect the budget.
And we're talking about, depending on how you measure it, Doug Henwood had a piece up that's saying it amounts to a 10% cut in benefits.
On how long you live, because it compounds over time.
That's right.
In the first 10 years, it's close to 5%, it's between 3.5 and 5%. And if you keep living longer, the effect gets greater.
Yeah, so the best way to beat that reduction in benefits is to die young. That's a strategy that I think financial advisors are basically going to be telling their clients. What you really need to do is just live a very full life, but don't go so long.
With a full but quick, relatively speaking, life.
Yes. All right. So I appreciate you giving us that breakdown. Nobody can do it better than you, frankly, in my opinion. So let's transition. So what's the deal? Why are you leaving me high and dry like this? What am I going to do?
Well, I mean, part of it is, to be frank, a personal decision. Over the last, I started blogging April 2004. So over those 8+ years, I just went back and calculated this. I've written about 22,000 blog posts, something a little bit more than that, actually. And at some level, you have to say that's enough, I think.
I was going to suggest 30.
it, as you know, takes a tremendous amount of diligent work. And I do have a wife that occasionally I like to check in on and see how she's doing. And it's something that requires a lot of dedication and effort, and something where you have to have a real sense of inspiration in order to keep it going. And that brings me to the second point. You know, why would close with that is saying that there are a lot of things that I may want to do around writing and political advocacy, but I don't know that I can think about them without getting off what ends up being a treadmill.
Yes.
When you're just immediately responding to everything that happens, and you tend to miss the forest for the tree.
Well, let me reiterate that there has been at least – I mean, at least once a week, I am in this office in the morning, and I just say to myself or somebody else in the room, Dan must not sleep. He must not sleep. I don't understand how he does this. And because, you know, not just the volume of work that you did, but the quality and the depth of your work has always been literally, I think, virtually unparalleled. And so I can certainly...
Well, let me just say two things about that. Number one is I think that there's a cumulative effect when you've been in this game for as long as I have, and you see these things over and over again. Not to favorably compare myself to a supreme being, but there's a line in Groundhog Day that I often use when people say, how do you do this? And it's the line where Bill Murray is talking about the fact that he's you know, living the same day over and over, and he says, you know, maybe God doesn't know everything. Maybe he's just been around so long that he just sees everything every day.
Right.
And that's kind of what it feels like, there's a wide storage of things that you can pull back to and call back to, because, you know, in Washington, what you find is these same things keep coming. Change CPI is something I've been writing about for probably 2-3 years. Because it keeps coming up over and over and over again. So that would be one thing I would say. The second thing is that I have a sense that the marginal utility of blogging has declined, and it's continuing to decline at a fairly rapid rate over time. And what I mean by that is that in 2004, blogging was a very new thing. It was more of an amateur thing, and it captured the imagination of a lot of people. It provided a genuine alternative to the discussion that happens in the traditional media. And I think that has waned.
It filled a void that is not as large as it was in 2004.
Right, and part of that is news organizations getting a little bit smarter in terms of who they hire and how they do their work, and part of it is also a regression to the mean in terms of the blogosphere. And the blogosphere kind of taking their cues more and more from not just traditional media, but from the very rapid-fire, meme-heavy land of social media.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like that's a game that is not necessarily it's just not a position, an environment that I feel like I have to be in. It just doesn't feel vital anymore. to me. And as I said, there are a number of new ways now since the introduction of the blogosphere to express yourself. You're doing one of them right now with your radio show, which is not a commercial product. I mean, it's not on commercial radio. You work on commercial radio on a separate thing, but you're able to have a major following through this podcast and live internet broadcast. So, you know, that's just an example that it's not like you have to, I just don't feel anymore like you have to be in the blogosphere.
Right.
To have this impact or whatever it is you want to achieve. And the truth is that I think in the sort of obsessive way of meticulously analyzing things as they happen and being very in the moment, you kind of lose sight of the larger picture. And I think I have more of an interest in demystifying that larger picture. So I don't know what it is I'm going to do. I mean, the first thing I want to do is be able to wake up in the morning and not think within 5 minutes I need to start my first blog post for the day.
Right.
That's going to be a good thing on a weekday. It's going to be a good thing to for my mental health to actually do. But over the longer term, I think the idea for me is to move into something that has more of a wide-ranging analysis that's slower, that's more deliberate, and more long-form. So I think that's where I'm headed. But it could be the case that I spend a month on the sidelines and I can't take it. I mean, the outpouring of support that I've received over the past couple weeks, and B, oddly enough, this Jonathan Chait dust-up that I had over the Medicare eligibility age brought me back to a place where I thought, okay, well, maybe I'm misreading this a little bit in terms of blogs not having as much of an impact anymore, because that certainly seems to. But so far that has not been enough to dissuade me from, you know, feeling the need to take a step back, reassess, figure out my strengths, and figure out where I can best fit into this new media landscape that we have.
Well, I mean, if anybody I know deserves a vacation, it's an extended vacation. It's you, because it's obviously a different medium, but I certainly can appreciate the sort of the feeling that you're on a treadmill. I don't know if people fully understand the just how much it takes out of you to have to be, you know, you hit that, you post that blog post. I mean, I feel it in the context of doing a radio show. I'm done with this show at 1:30 Eastern. At 1:31, I'm thinking about the next show. It's like that, like in Lost, where those guys had to hit that machine and reset it as the countdown was going, and it's a much shorter time period before you got to put up that next blog post, and constantly being, it is a very weird thing, I think, you know, for people, particularly, you know, I got to imagine, like yourself, who walk around and literally it's like you've taken the blue pill or whatever it is. You're walking around and seeing politics in a way that no one around you can really fully understand. You know, you're just walking through and going like, you guys don't really, there's another level of this that, you know, but with that.
And I would say, it's not just about output. It's about input. I've been able to write fairly quickly throughout my life, basically. But you need to know a lot of stuff before you can actually write it down and make your opinions. But even if you're doing it in sort of an iterative way where you're not collecting all the information and then writing a big story, but you're kind of following the story as it develops, even for that, you need to take in a lot of input. And, you know, more and more, it seems like kind of a pinball machine where, okay, I got the high score today, but I know that tomorrow I also have to get the high score.
Right.
And so it becomes more of a, you know, some people can call it content farming, where you do your farming chores for the day, but it basically never ends. And the next day you're going to have to do the same level, if not more, chores. And if you stop a day, then you have to do twice as many chores. So, I mean, it becomes a little more all-consuming. And I think that affects the quality of the work, too.
Hmm.
And so that's a part of why I think it makes a lot of sense to step back and figure out, okay, what segment of this can I take on and chew on? Because, you know, my mandate is, I did this site called FDL News. And that doesn't give you a lot of parameters, you know. there's news is a fairly broad category, and so I felt the need, if the national conversation was moving in a certain direction, to, you know, highlight that. And I also felt the need, if certain stories were being under covered, for example, the mortgage foreclosure crisis and foreclosure fraud and things of that nature. Which I think were absurdly uncovered by the traditional media. I also wanted to highlight those more. So at some level, you need to draw a line and say, okay, I can either cover these, I can either spin these 20 plates, or I could craft one plate. This is a terrible metaphor, similar to your metaphor earlier in the show. but... You know what I mean, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's an easier thing to conceive of, and I think it will ultimately end up being a more quality product if you can wrestle it to the ground and confine it and come up with something that is more deliberative and more wide range.
Give me a sense when you look at, I mean, because it seems to me that what you're doing is reevaluating where within the context of our media culture you're going to have the most impact, which is a question of, you know, on one hand, it's a question of sort of assessing the life you want to have and the skill set you have and where you can be most effective. The other part of that is sort of contemplating that is a process and sort of functional question. The other part that informs that is to look upon where our politics are and what the output or the implications of our media culture is, and where it's also most important in terms of your political disposition to plug yourself into that to have the impact that you want to have. And so give me a sense of what that part of the formula looks like. How do you perceive now, if in 2004 the question was that there was simply no mechanism to espouse in many respects, because, you know, that was, you started right when Air America started. And when Air America started, it got a huge amount of press and it was a huge revelation because there was no other outlet now. We have MSNBC, we can argue as to where they are politically, but certainly they're a different beast than existed back in 2004. We have Current. Mm-hmm. We still have some radio out there. We have these things like the Huffington Post, which didn't exist, the Center for American Progress, which is barely around, Media Matters, which was just forming. So where do you see, not just where you see yourself being most effective, but what do you see the argument is that wasn't there before that you can impact or are interested in impacting?
That's a really good question. I think that what you've seen since 2004, maybe that shouldn't be the line that you draw, because I think you see it in sort of a parabolic kind of arc. There wasn't this alternative, and then this alternative grew, and it was probably at the height of its, the apex of its influence or power, whatever you want to call it, maybe in between 06, 07, 08.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think that has waned, and it's become sort of an adjunct rather than it's something that looks at the conversation rather than moves the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is the fact that there's a Democratic president, and people have these strange loyalties around that, so I think that has depressed the quality of what that alternative media or progressive media has been able to accomplish. And I think that as far as for me personally, what do you do with that? I think there are some undiscovered corners that really aren't being discussed, certainly not in progressive media. And a lot of those revolve around Wall Street and housing and the financial industry, and you know, the reason for the Great Recession and its unreconstructed aftermath. So I think that's an area where I could maybe be useful. Again, I've kind of put off the notion of exactly what I am going to do until I take a breath, but that's an example of somewhere where I think I've built up a record and also a number of contacts and sources, and so that is a possibility out there. But you know, I would just say that we still need a progressive media in America, even though. You are absolutely correct in terms of all these changes that have taken place relative to 2004. It still feels like, and actually this is kind of different than what it was like back then, that more and more it's almost a, how do I say this? It feels more like an adjunct of, you know, whether it's an administration kind of set of arguments, or it's not have the vitality.
It seems to me that part of that is a function of the broader liberal audience. I mean, one of the because you know, and I'm one of the things that I saw as a you know, aside from other issues, obviously the benefit of a President Obama is that. I have a better sense of where the politics on the from the center to the left run than I did under the Bush administration, or it was more explicit. You know, there were times where, you know, I was where, you know, I mean, I use him as an example, but I don't know, it's sort of a blunt instrument. But, you know, Jonathan Alter, for instance, you know, like where he was. I always found him a little bit establishment oriented, but it's a lot clearer when you know, these guys talk about Social Security, you can raise it a little bit. What's the big deal? That type of thing.
Right.
And when you have you know, where these battles between Chait was at the New Republic, and that's always been a chasm on the left. You know, back in that day, the New Republic's changed a little bit, but that sort of more establishment oriented, the more pundit, not the more pundit, the more wonkish identifying left people on the left versus the more sort of activists and I think, you know, guys like you and I live in sort of in between that world in some respects.
Sure.
But ideologically speaking, there does not seem to be that appetite, even if it's falling, even if we're advocating or talking about the same issues on the left for that interscene battle.
I agree. And I think what you might be able to say is that the blogosphere, progressive media, used to have a relatively small audience. And now, as it has a bigger share of the audience, it's finding that its audience is much more fractured ideologically. That, you know, then progressive media has a choice to make. I mean, do they chase the larger audience, which is more fractured, maybe more moderate, and maybe more willing to, you know, follow the dictates of a Jonathan Alter or something like that? Or does it splinter again? And then you have sort of the establishment progressive media, and then you have the sort of more radical progressive media. I think that transformation is taking place. It has been, you know, obviously since in the last couple of years. But I think the overall instinct has been to either A, just focus on Republicans and try to, you know, not talk, only talk in quiet rooms about the things that are happening within one's own party or on one's own ideological side, or two, offer a full-throated defense based on whatever notions of compromising sound judgment and wonkish technocratic talk to make those defenses. And I think we've seen both of those play out over the last couple of years. Do you agree with that?
I think particularly, you know, from my perspective online, I mean, the irony is that for me, 5 or 6 years ago, the dividing line was, if I can get on television at any given point, I am there and going to face, it's going to be adversarial for the most part. And it's going to be a very bright line. Now I am brought on to television ostensibly because I share the same ideological perspective, but I am maintaining some adversarial thing. So I'm seeing a change in, you know, who I'm arguing with about what, which, you know, I would much rather be having an argument left versus left center than, you know, sort of a left center amalgamation versus right in some respects, just in terms of moving the ball forward. But there's much less of an appetite for that as in terms of audiences. Now, I think that may change over time, and it requires a repositioning, you know, either by medium or not. I mean, that's, you know, I've made a conscious decision at one point to basically forego, you know, commercial radio for you know, very much that reason. There's a lot more freedom in terms of content in this perspective, and I think I'm going to be able to make a go of it as a business model if I don't, you know, if I don't pass out first. That change is it's a harder fight, and it's a less, in some ways, it's a more surgical fight in some respects. And so there's a lot less sort of bon ami, I guess.
Also, I think it's more critical because otherwise, you're sort of going with the winds of not really popular opinion, but the winds of some amalgam of what establishment opinion, what the establishment believes popular opinion to be, or what they believe must be done in sort of an incrementalist technocratic way. So, where this relates to what I'm doing, I don't know. But
well, I will say this: I think that, you know, one of the reasons why I've enjoyed reading you so much is that because I find that I continue to read those bloggers and even ones whose prescriptions I don't always necessarily agree with, but who perceive the real battle lines to be between the establishment and everyone else. And that is a critical distinction, I think, in terms of the way that things have fractured. And, you know.
And I think we've lost that a little bit in the blogosphere. And so, you know, I can only sort of, you know, follow my own personal star, I suppose. But if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it in such a way that doesn't. Tries not, at least, to fall into those traps.
Well, David, I really appreciate you coming on. I know you got to run now, and hopefully stay in touch. And, you know,
absolutely.
I'm going to keep my eyes open for everything you're doing. Perhaps a good time to reiterate that you and I first met doing a student film at the University of Michigan.
That's right.
Oh, my God. 21
Almost
years
20
ago.
Years ago. Almost 20 years ago.
I think it was at least 20 years ago.
I don't remember if it was 92, 93,
maybe
or 94.
It was 94. Maybe
it was almost 20.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's – and I knew right then when I met you, you're going to be a future star of the blogosphere.
That we would have a 45 – even though there wasn't a blogosphere at that point or blogging. Or
I had a lot better, clearer vision for the future at that time than I do now.
Right.
But, David, can't tell you how much I appreciate your work over the years. Can't tell you how much I look forward to seeing what's next for you.
Well, thank you.
And
thank you, and thank you to everyone who's been – I mean, I'm always stunned that anyone would bother to read what I have to say, to be honest with you. And so to everyone who has paid attention over the years, I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for your patience with me while I figure out what I'm going to do next.
David Dayan, folks, head over to Fire Dog Lake News for the next couple of days. Send some of your personal messages of greeting. But do that after you contact your congressperson and your senator and tell them no way any cuts to Social Security or Medicare. Yeah, or
there
Medicaid, for that matter. David, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. I kept him along. I know he had an appointment to go to. But that's how I do it. If he's going to leave the blog for, I'm going to get an extra 10, 15 minutes out of that dude.
Didn't seem like he minded, though.
No, that's you know, that's why I pepper in the compliments there. So he doesn't have a chance to look at his watch. That's the way you do.
Interesting things are going to come from him, though. Doesn't it sound like...
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, just...
It's not like a retirement from influencing the conversation.
No.
From writing good stuff.
No. I really... It is hard for me right now to even contemplate someone who I think has really been as, you know... When you say prolific, it sometimes has the wrong connotations. Because people just think, well, he just turns stuff out. His pieces are always thoughtful. They're always measured. They are always incredibly reported. And, you know, I see David in not just in his context as a blogger, but also on listservs. And the idea, frankly, I got to say, and maybe I should have asked him about this, the idea that he's not writing for a major publication now is just stunning to me. And I'm not convinced, frankly, that it isn't a function of his perspective of being not cowed by the establishment. And I am very hard pressed to find anybody who writes with the sort of the depth and the I don't think I've ever read a piece of his where I have gone back and said, you know what, he's wrong about that. Factually, I mean, maybe I have quibbles with everybody I read at one point or another, but I've never had a piece where he said, like, he's wrong in terms of sort of the facts. He's wrong in terms of his assessment. It really is, I mean, it's a huge... I think it's a huge loss. It's certainly going to make my job harder.
You know, the other thing that I think just bears repeating about him that's amazing, I've recommended him to people who don't necessarily have particularly progressive politics, just because this guy will explain to you clearly and concisely what is in a bill.
If there's
what is in a negotiation. There is no one clearer, sharper, or just – it's sharp. It's great, just even on that level of like a clinical
– well,
this is actually what's in something.
We will post at least – at the very least as a YouTube, a discreet one, his explanation of this deal from President Obama. Because if you can find a better, clearer explanation – of the implications of this on the this offer on the spending side, on the revenue side, and on the long-term implications for social insurance side, then send it to me, because I read everybody on this. You know, the point that Dave was making in terms of input, I'll tell you that the ratio of stories that I read that I talk about is somewhere probably around 50 to 1. Even like the story, the ratio from stories that I pull and sit in front of me that I end up talking about is about 20 to 1, I would say. And then the stories I read beyond that. So I've read just about everything that people from the libertarian, hardcore conservative side to the wonky left liberal side on this offer already. And I can tell you that I have not heard. I've heard all those numbers, disparate numbers in those different ways. I had a good sense of it, but he cuts to the quick, so he will be missed. We're going to take a break, head into the second half of the program. Oh, this just breaking. Holy cow. This is interesting because last night I heard that the CEO of Cerberus, owned by billionaire financier Steven Feinberg, there was going to be a march on his home in New York City tomorrow night over Cerberus's capital management owning the country's largest gun maker, the Freedom Group. There was going to be a march on Feinberg's house. And one of the things that Elliot Spitzer, when I was on Current last night, was talking about was there has to be an attack to shame this guy, because there are pensions, public pensions in this fund. There are investments in mutual fund groups in this fund. And this guy can be shamed. And I got to say, that is the most the quickest I've. It is now being reported by the New York Times that the investment firm Cerberus Capital Management has announced it will sell its stake in the country's largest gun maker after one of the company's guns was used in the Connecticut school shootings. Freedom Group is going to be put up for sale just hours after one of its largest investors, the California Teachers Pension Fund, said it was reviewing its relationship with the firm. Also, late Monday, the California treasurer raised concerns about the state's pension funds' investments in gun companies. This is extremely effective. We need to make gun makers stigmatized. We need to make people who own large caches of weapons in their home stigmatized. They need to be shamed in some respect. They need to be aware that it's perfectly within their rights, at least as interpreted by this right-wing court, for them to own semi-automatic rifles that can rip apart people in just a matter of seconds. It may be within their rights as interpreted by this Supreme Court. But they're going to be seen as lepers. They're going to be seen as people who, you know, haven't taught manners to their kids or whatever it is, whatever the social mores are. And if you're going to be a billionaire hedge fund owner and you're going to profit off of the death and destruction, then you're going to be ostracized for it. So this is good news. very good news. Freedom Group. It's just another way of saying we make a lot of weapons that end up killing a lot of people. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Just a little bit of house. Well, I'll give you the house cleaning tomorrow. Or housekeeping, somebody sent me an email, said I'm using house cleaning the wrong way. Well, same. Folks, some key ways of supporting this program. Becoming a member at majority.fm. It is still your membership which supports this program, gives us 98.3% of our revenue now. You can visit our sponsors. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. Excuse me, /majority. credomobile.com/majority. Check out the great deal they have for you until December 31st. It's a great company. And they're also a great political action committee. And so I would also make sure you sign up to notify your members of Congress that you will not stand for them cutting Social Security or Medicare. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Organic, if you want it, use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Great holiday gift. I think they can get it to you in time. Well, maybe for President's Day. I don't know if you're going to be able to give it as a Christmas present at this point, but give them a coupon, you know, draw one up. That's what my family does. I'm about to get you this. If you're buying junk on Amazon and you're not using our link, shame on you. It's so easy. I know sometimes people forget. Not saying, you know, Amazon's necessarily the best place for you to buy your stuff, but if you are someone who uses Amazon to buy your stuff, go to majority.fm/support the show. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff there. You will notice no difference, but we will. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the phone number. If you want to be part of the program, we're taking your IMs at Majority FM. We shall see you in just a moment.